There were five men still in the room with me, but none of them would meet my eye, and two soon left. The old man returned with a small fish that had expired upon a slice of coarse bread, and said,
"Eat this and go."
He stood and watched me while I had my supper. When I had finished it, I asked where I could sleep.
"No rooms, I told you."
If a palace had stood with open doors half a chain away, I do not think I could have driven myself to leave that inn to go to it. I said,
"I'll sleep in this chair, then. You're not likely to have more trade tonight, anyway."
"Wait,"
he said, and left me. I heard him talking to a woman in another room. When I woke, he was shaking me by the shoulder.
"Will you sleep three in a bed?"
"With whom?"
"Two optimates, I swear to you. Very nice men, traveling together."
The woman in the kitchen shouted something I could not understand.
"Did you hear that?"
the old man continued.
"One of them's not even come in yet. This time of night he probably won't come at all. There'll be just the two of you."
"If these men have rented a bedchamber..."
"They won't object, I promise. Truth is, Carnifex, they're behind. Three nights here, and only paid for the first."
So I was to be used as an eviction notice. That did not disturb me much, and in fact it seemed somewhat promising. If the man sleeping there tonight left, I would have the room to myself. I clambered to my feet and followed the old man up a crooked stair. The room we entered was not locked, but it was as dark as a tomb. I could hear heavy breathing.
"Goodman,"
the old fellow bawled, forgetting he had said his tenant was an optimate.
"What do you call yourself? Baldy? Baldanders? I brought company for you. If you won't pay your rate, you got to take in boarders."
There was no reply.
"Here, Master Carnifex," the old man said to me. "I'll make you a light."
He puffed at a bit of punk until it was bright enough to ignite a stub of candle. The room was small and held no furniture but a bed. In it, asleep on his side, as it appeared, with his back toward us and his legs drawn up, was the largest man I had ever seen, a man who might fairly have been called a giant.
"Aren't you going to wake, Goodman Baldanders, and see who your lodge mate might be?"
I wanted to go to bed and told the old man to leave us. He objected, but I pushed him out of the room, and as soon as he was gone, sat down on the unoccupied side of the bed and pulled off my boots and stockings. The weak light of the candle confirmed that I had developed several blisters. I took off my cloak and spread it on the worn counterpane. For a moment I considered whether I should take off my belt and trousers or sleep in them. Prudence and weariness together urged the latter, and I noticed that the giant seemed fully dressed. With a feeling of inexpressible fatigue and relief, I blew out the candle and lay down to spend the first night outside the Mattachin Tower that I could recall.
"Never."
The tone was so deep and resonant, almost like the lowest notes of an organ, that I was not certain at first what the meaning of the word had been, or even if it had been a word at all. I mumbled,
"What did you say?"
"Baldanders."
"I know, the innkeeper told me. I'm Severian." I was lying on my back with Terminus Est, which I had brought into the bed for safekeeping, between us. In the dark, I could not tell whether my companion had rolled to face me or not, yet I was certain I would have felt any motion of that enormous frame.
"You strike off."
"You heard us when we came in, then. I thought you were asleep." My lips shaped themselves to say I was no Carnifex, but a journeyman of the Torturers Guild. Then I recalled my disgrace, and that Thrax has sent for an executioner. I said, "Yes, I'm a headsman, but you need not fear me. I only do what I am feed to do."
"Tomorrow, then."
"Yes, tomorrow will be time enough for us to meet and talk." And then I dreamed, though it may have been that Baldander's words, too, were a dream. Yet I do not think so. And if they were, it was a different dream. I bestrode a great leather-winged being under a lowering sky. Just equipoised between the rack of cloud and a twilight land, we slid down a hill of air. Hardly once, it seemed to me, the finger-winged soarer flapped her long pinions. The dying sun was before us, and it seemed we matched the speed of Urth, for it stood unmoving at the horizon, though we flew on and on. At last I saw a change in the land, and at first I thought it a desert. Far off, no cities or farms or woods or fields appeared, but only a level waste, a blackened purple in color, featureless and nearly static. The leathern-winged one observed it as well, or perhaps snatched some odor from the air. I felt iron muscles beneath me grow tense. and there were three wing strokes together. The purple waste showed flecks of white. After a time, I became aware that its seeming stillness was a sham born of uniformity. It was the same everywhere, but everywhere in motion, the sea. The world river Uruburus, cradling Urth. Then, for the first time, I looked behind me, seeing all the country of humankind swallowed in the night. When it was gone, and there was everywhere beneath us the waste of rolling water and nothing more, the beast turned her head to regard me. Her beak was the beak of an ibis, her face the face of a hag. On her head was a mitre of bone. For an instant we regarded each other, and I seemed to know her thought. You dream, but were you to wake from your waking, I would be there. Her motion changed as a lugger's does when the sailors make it to come about on the opposite tack. One pinion dipped, the other rose until it pointed toward the sky, and I scrabbled at the scaled hide and plummeted into the sea. The shock of the impact woke me. I twitched in every joint and heard the giant mutter in his sleep. In much the same way, I murmured too and groped to find if my sword still lay at my side, and slept again. The water closed over me, yet I did not drown. I felt I might breathe water, yet I did not breathe. Everything was so clear that I felt I fell through an emptiness more translucent than air. Far off loomed great shapes, things hundreds of times larger than a man. Some seemed ships, and some clouds. One was a living head without a body. One had 100 heads. A blue haze obscured them, and I saw below me a country of sand carved by the currents. A palace stood there that was greater than our citadel. But it was ruinous, its halls as unroofed as its gardens. Through it moved immense figures, white as leprosy. Nearer I fell, and they turned up their faces to me, faces such as I had seen once beneath Gile. They were women, naked, with hair of sea-foam green and eyes of coral. Laughing, they watched me fall, and their laughter came bubbling up to me. Their teeth were white and pointed, each a finger's length. I fell nearer. Their hands reached up to me and stroked me as a mother strokes her child. The gardens of the palace held sponges and sea anemones and countless other beauties to which I could put no name. The great women circled me round, and I was only a doll before them. "Who are you?" I asked. "And what do you do here?"
"We are the brides of Abaya, the sweethearts and playthings, the toys and valentines of Abaya. The land could not hold us. Our breasts are battering rams, our buttocks would break the backs of bulls. Here we feed, floating and growing, until we are great enough to mate with Abaya, who will one day devour the continents."
"And who am I?" Then they laughed altogether, and their laughter was like surf upon a beach of glass.
"We will show you," they said. "We will show you."
One took me by each hand, as sisters take their sister's child, and lifted me up and swam with me through the garden. Their fingers were webbed, and as long as my arm from shoulder to elbow. They halted, settling through the water like carracks sinking, until their feet and mine touched the strand. There stood before us a low wall, and on it a little stage and curtain, such as are used for children's entertainments. Our roiling of the water seemed to flutter the kerchief-sized cloth. It rippled and swayed and began to draw back, as though teased by an unseen hand. At once there appeared the tiny figure of a man of sticks. His limbs were twigs, still showing bark and green bud. His body was a quarter span of branch, big through as my thumb, and his head a knot, whose whorls formed his eyes and mouth. He carried a club, which he brandished at us, and moved as if he were alive. When the wooden man had jumped for us and struck the little stage with his weapon to show his ferocity, there appeared the figure of a boy armed with a sword. This marionette was as finely finished as the other was crude. It might have been a real child reduced to the size of a mouse. After both had bowed to us, the tiny figures fought. The wooden man performed prodigious leaps and seemed to fill the stage with the blows of his cudgel. The boy danced like a dust mote in a sunbeam to avoid it, darting at the wooden man to slash with his pin-sized blade. At last the wooden figure collapsed. The boy strode over as if to set his foot upon its chest, but before he could do so, the wooden figure floated from the stage, and turning limply and lazily, arose until it vanished from sight, leaving behind the boy and the cudgel and the sword, both broken. I seemed to hear, no doubt it was really the squeaking of cartwheels on the street outside, a flourish of toy trumpets. I woke because a third person had come into the room. He was a small, brisk man with fiery red hair, well and even foppishly dressed. When he saw me awake, he threw back the shutters that had covered the window, bringing red sunlight streaming in. "My partner," he said, "sleeps soundly always. His snoring didn't deafen you?" "I slept well myself," I told him. "And if he snored, I didn't hear him." That seemed to please the small man, who showed a good many gold teeth when he smiled. "He does. He snores to shake earth, I assure you. Happy you got your rest, anyway." He extended a delicate, well-cared-for hand. "I am Dr. Tallis."
"The journeyman Severian." I threw off the thin coverings and stood up to take it.
"You wear black, I see. What guild is that?"
"It is the Fulligen of the Torturers."
"Ah."
He cocked his head to one side like a thrush and hopped about to look at me from various angles.
"You're a tall fellow. That's a shame. But all that sooty stuff is very impressive."
"We find it practical," I said. "The Oubliette is a dirty place, and Fulligen doesn't show bloodstains."
"You have humor. That's excellent. There are few advantages, I'll tell you, that profit a man more than humor. Humor will draw a crowd. Humor will calm a mob or reassure a nursery school. Humor will get you on and get you off and pull in Assimis like a magnet."
I had only the vaguest idea of what he was saying, but seeing that he was in an affable mood, I ventured, "I hope I didn't discommode you. The landlord said I was to sleep here, and there was no room for another person in the bed."
"Oh, no, not at all. I never came back. Found a better place to pass the night. I sleep very little, I may as well tell you. And I'm a light sleeper, too. But I had a good night of it, an excellent night." "Where are you going this morning, Optimate?"
I was fumbling under the bed for my boots.
"First to look for some breakfast, I suppose. After that, out of the city, to the north."
"Excellent. No doubt my partner would appreciate a breakfast. It will do him a world of good. And we're traveling north. After a most successful tour of the city, you know. Going back home now. Played the east bank down and playing the west up. Perhaps we'll stop at the House Absolute on our way north. That's the dream, you know, in the profession. Play the Autarch's Palace. Or come back if you've already played there. Chrysos by the hatful."
"I've met one other person, at least, who dreamed of going back."
"Don't put on that long face. You must tell me about him sometime. But now, if we're to go to breakfast... Baldanders! Wake up! Come, Baldanders, come! Wake up!"
He danced to the foot of the bed and grasped the giant by an ankle.
"Baldanders!" "Don't take him by the shoulder, Optimate."
I had made no motion to do so.
"He thrashes about sometimes." "Baldanders!"
The giant murmured and stirred.
"A new day, Baldanders! Still alive! Time to eat and defecate and make love. All that. Up now, or we'll never get home."
There was no sign that the giant had heard him. It was as if the murmur of the moment before had been only a protest voiced in a dream, or his death rattle. Dr. Tallis seized the foul blankets with both hands and swept them back. The monstrous shape of his partner lay revealed. He was even taller than I had supposed, nearly too tall for the bed, though he slept with his knees drawn almost to his chin. His shoulders were an L across, high and hunched. His face I could not see. It lay buried in his pillow. There were strange scars about his neck and ears.
"Baldanders!"
His hair was grizzled, and despite the innkeeper's pretended error, very thick.
"Baldanders!" "Your pardon, Optimate, but may I borrow that sword?"
"No," I said. "You may not."
"Oh, I'm not going to kill him or anything of that sort. I only want to use the flat of it."
I shook my head, and when Dr. Tallis saw I was still adamant, he began to rummage about the room.
"Left my stick downstairs. Vile custom, they'll thieve it. I should learn to limp. I really should. There's nothing here at all."
He darted out the door and was back in a moment carrying an ironwood walking stick with a gilt brass knob.
"Now then, Baldanders!"
The strokes fell upon the giant's broad back like the big raindrops that precede a thunderstorm.
Quite suddenly, the giant sat up.
I'm awake, Doctor.
His face was large and coarse, but sensitive and sad as well.
Have you decided to kill me at last?
What are you talking about, Bald Anders?
Oh, you mean the Optimate here. He's not going to do you any hurt. He shared the bed with you, and now he's going to join us at breakfast.
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.